From KGW News, this is Straight Talk with Laurel Porter.
Hello and welcome to Straight Talk. I'm Laurel Porter. One of the state's biggest and most important agencies has a new leader. Dr. Sejal Hathi took over as the head of the Oregon Health Authority in January. And Dr. Hathi has her work cut out for her as the state deals with widespread drug abuse, behavioral health system challenges, and a lack of access to treatment. At 32 years old, she's held a number of high-profile positions. After getting her master's in business administration and a medical degree from Stanford, she's advised the UN Secretary General on healthcare policy. During the pandemic, Dr. Hathi cared for patients at Massachusetts General Hospital, and she served on the faculties of Harvard and Johns Hopkins universities. In addition, she was a senior advisor to the White House on public health. And most recently, she was Deputy Commissioner for Public Health Services in New Jersey. Dr. Hathi is a first-generation American with parents of Indian descent. She says they came to this country with the quest to attain the American dream. In her new position, Dr. Hathi oversees a budget of $17 billion and 5,000 employees. The Oregon Health Authority also oversees the Oregon Health Plan, the state's Medicaid program, public health, healthcare systems, and the Oregon State Hospital. I'm pleased to welcome my guest, the new director of the Oregon Health Authority, Dr. Sejal Hathi. Welcome to Straight Talk, Director. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Laurel.
You have such an impressive resume. How did we get you here in Oregon? What attracted you to the state?
Well, Oregon is a beautiful state, and my husband and I are just so thrilled to be able to call it our new home. But I've had my eye on Oregon for a number of years now. This is a state that has, for decades, set the vanguard of bold, progressive, imaginative health policy, doing everything from being the first to articulate and to center an ambitious goal to eliminate health inequities, to using its groundbreaking Medicaid waiver program, leveraging federal healthcare dollars to address social needs from housing to food insecurity. And I wanted to be part of an agency, a team that was willing to do those hard things, that had that tradition and that legacy of leadership and innovation. And I'm here to carry that forward.
Well, your predecessors have all been white, middle-aged men. What do you want our viewers to know about you, what you bring to the job, and what your approach will be?
Well, firstly, I'm grateful to join an agency with a legacy of committed enduring leadership, like that exemplified by Dr. Goldberg and Pat Allen in years past. But I also want to note that I have no illusions about the road ahead. I know that it will be hard and full of challenges. But I'm here because I've seen and I believe in our capacity to do those hard things. And I have the commitment and the grit and the passion to get it done. I've served in the highest levels of agency leadership in New Jersey, helped shape progressive public health policy at the White House, and built and scaled numerous global organizations. And it's that passion and that experience that I plan to bring here to Oregon, that too with an incredible agency team.
Well, let's talk about that tough road ahead that you were talking about. Oregon has some of the highest incidence of mental illness and is consistently ranked at or near the bottom when it comes to access to treatment. And the legislature in 2021 tried to address that with a massive $1.3 billion package to expand residential facilities, try to hire more behavioral health care workers. Then this past legislative session, they added another $85 million. But an Oregon Health Authority study shows that we need 3,000 adult mental health beds at a cost of $500 million. In your opinion, what's it going to take to get to where we need to be, and how long is it going to take?
Well, Laura, I think what's important to highlight here is that this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. Behavioral health has been understaffed, under-resourced, underfunded for decades. And the legislature has given us a good foundation on which to build with the $1.5 billion it's invested over the last few years. But against the backdrop of that long history of under-resourcing, it's still just a drop in the bucket. And we need to commit to this task with persistence and with grit and relentless focus in order to get the job done. And that's why I'm so glad to be a part of this administration and to work with Governor Kotek, for whom behavioral health is very much one of her top three priorities, as it is mine. And so you'll be seeing a lot from us over the coming months.
Well, one of the hurdles to improving access to treatment, increasing that, is having an adequate behavioral health care workforce. And the money allocated by the legislature just really isn't enough. And these folks do critical jobs, but they don't make that much money. What are you planning to do to try to recruit and retain more health care professionals?
I'm glad that you are emphasizing workforce, because I truly believe that at the center of our behavioral health crisis is the severe workforce shortage. We can't deliver evidence-based treatment if we don't have the providers to do so. And so I think about expanding our workforce in three ways. One, recruiting, and that involves providing scholarships, loan forgiveness, loan repayments in order to entice providers into the field. I think about it in terms of retention, making these jobs that are joyful, that are safe, that are full of dignity, and that empower our providers to do what they do best, which is serve our patients rather than navigate extensive documentation burdens. And finally, I think of it in terms of amplification, expanding the capacity of our providers to do their job, for instance, by leveraging technology and telemedicine, which we've seen embraced at the national level too, through additional federal regulatory flexibilities. So we're exploring all of these mechanisms to expand the workforce, to build the pipeline of providers that can meet people where they are when they need it.
And those providers really, really are our heroes. We've shared a reporting series here at KGW called Uncommitted. Our investigative reporter, Evan Watson, talked to all sorts of people, including families, doctors, judges, prosecutors, and more, who say that Oregon standards for involuntary mental health treatment are just too high, that an imminent danger threshold is too difficult to reach, so a lot of people with severe mental illness aren't getting the help that they need. Would you agree with that, and what would you change about Oregon standards of care?
So I'll note that there is a bipartisan commitment at the legislature to evaluating the same question, and there is a work group that has been erected that plans to issue recommendations for the next legislative session in 2025. So I am eagerly awaiting their verdict and their insights. But what I will also note is that it has to be a both and conversation. We can certainly lower civil commitment standards, as you are implying, but that's not going to be enough to solve our capacity challenge. What we really need is to expand the capacity of our community-based behavioral health system to serve those with highest acuity illnesses. We need additional residential treatment beds, as we just discussed. We need additional inpatient beds in order to care for individuals that may meet that civil commitment bar. And so what we're really focusing on as an agency and as a state is investing money into building that treatment capacity, again, for our most seriously mentally ill.
Let's expand a little bit on that, the deinstitutionalization that the federal government did, releasing patients from hospitals into the community with the idea that there would be treatment options available in the community. Do you think that practice has worked, or do you think we need to expand the Oregon State Hospital? Do we need another facility like that?
Well, I would love to be able to expand the capacity of the Oregon State Hospital. I'll share that. But what I'll also note is that when President Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Act, it was intended to be a two-part piece of legislation, both to advance deinstitutionalization and, again, to build up community-level infrastructure to expand treatment capacity in communities where people live, work, and play so that they could be treated closest to home. And while deinstitutionalization certainly happened and the number of inpatient beds across the country waned, the rebuilding of that community-level infrastructure did not happen. And I think that's where we failed as a country. And that's where we need to focus.
Let's talk about our young people. A Lund report last year said that Oregon's rate of teenagers dying from overdose is growing faster than in any other state. And it blames in part the state's failure to respond to youth drug addiction and to the fentanyl crisis. There's a lack of youth addiction treatment and prevention programs, and they say a lack of leadership in the area. What are your plans to address the needs of Oregon's youngest residents?
Well, I'm glad you're focusing on youth because we know that at least 75% of behavioral health disorders, mental illness, and substance use does begin before the age of 18. And so every dollar we invest in youth services is another dollar toward prevention and less pressure, again, on that treatment capacity of our adult behavioral health system. And so we are fully committed, again, as an agency, to both building the workforce of providers that can specifically address young people's needs, and also investing in early intervention and early childhood supports, so that a lot of the stressful experiences that young people experience when they're at their littlest can be addressed in a family setting to prevent those issues from spiraling further. And we've already started to do this. I'll just give you one example, because we received word from the federal government that a proposal we had submitted a few months ago was approved to allow a greater variety of providers in school-based settings to deliver mental health services and bill Medicaid for them, which should expand access across our K-12 community, which is considered the best gateway to accessing young people and to providing them these vital services. So we're really excited about what we
can do. And would that include drug prevention programs as well?
Yes, and in fact, we are partnering with the Oregon Department of Education to create curriculum to teach young people about drug use and preventing its greatest harms.
You are conducting a listening tour. You have been across the region. What are some of the things you've heard and learned that will inform how you lead the OHA?
So I've made four visits thus far. We have three more. I'm visiting every major region of the state. And that was a commitment that I made even before I began, an ask that I made of my team, because I recognize that I am new to the state. And I would like the vision that I set to be representative of and reflective of the real needs, priorities, and challenges of people on the ground who have been doing this work for years and who have ideas about what we should do next. And so I've heard a number of recurrent themes. The need for greater investments in our workforce is one of them. The different ways that health inequities manifest in rural communities and coastal communities and urban communities is another. And then I've heard again about just how tired and burnt out a lot of our local public health and county mental health providers and programs are, and how, as a state, we can play a vital role in bringing those groups back together and providing them ongoing support as federal funds may wane.
Well, one of the things Republican lawmakers have said, they've called on you to rebuild public trust in the agency after OHA failed to publish a 2021 study that it commissioned at taxpayers' expense that showed increasing beer and wine taxes would do little to curb drinking among the heaviest drinkers. Now, this was before you were hired, but it's damaged OHA's reputation. How do you plan to rebuild trust, and as the Republican lawmakers asked, to root out any corruption?
So I prefer to take a strength-based approach to this question. And what I would say, Laurel, is that trust is the lifeblood of all of the work that we do at OHA, and frankly, that any government agency, and especially government health agency, must do. And we're facing a national dissolution of trust. Americans of my generation across the country increasingly suffer from a lack of trust in one another, in our institutions, in our very form of government itself. And so it's all the more essential that we think about how we can strengthen and rebuild that trust, both with our partners like the legislature, and more importantly, with the communities that we serve. And so I have made trust a central theme of my tenure, and I think about it in terms of three pillars. One, increasing transparency. How can we proactively communicate the decisions that we make and the reasons why we make them? Two, improving accountability. How do we prove that we are here to keep the promises that we have made and to faithfully and efficiently execute the investments the legislature has given us? And finally, how do we foster belonging and ensure that we are building a workplace and an ecosystem that is inclusive of the diverse array of viewpoints and heritages that encompass Oregon? And I believe that trust cannot just be an attitude. It has to be an operational principle. It has to be a tactical plan. And so we're thinking hard about how we can continuously measure that trust and deliver with accountability on it.
The governor signed into law the bill passed by the legislature that decriminalizes drug possession with the goal of not sending offenders to jail necessarily, but giving them probation, treatment, possibly have them go into a deflection program. Big reason a lot of people feel like Measure 110 failed was what we've been talking a lot about, lack of treatment options. What role do you and the Oregon Health Authority have in making sure that treatment is available so that people don't end up going to jail under this new law?
Yeah, so our priority in the short session of the legislature and our priority now remains protecting and distributing those vital treatment dollars to ensure that people most in need, people who use drugs, can get access to the recovery services, the harm reduction services, and the housing services that Measure 110 enabled. That's what we're here to do. That's what we will do. And I'm proud to say that Measure 110, for all of the political debates that surround it, has increased access to those services. It's improved it's increased the number of people who access substance use disorder services by more than 300%. The number of people who have access to employment services by more than 300%. So it's clearly filling gaps in the system. And we look forward to, with our next grant application cycle, continuing to build that infrastructure in community.
Dr. Hathi, it's time for us to take a break. When we come back, Dr. Hathi shares a powerful personal story with us that helped guide her into the field of medicine. We're back in 2 minutes. Welcome back to Straight Talk. I'm Laurel Porter. We're talking with the new head of one of the largest and most critical agencies in the state of Oregon, the Oregon Health Authority. Welcome once again to my guest, OHA Director Dr. Sejal Hathi. Thanks again for being here.
It's great to be here.
I know one of the important goals for the Oregon Health Authority is trying to eliminate health inequities by 2030, which is a short 6 years away. What does eliminating health inequities look like, and how do you plan to try to get to that goal?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking that question, Laurel. I do want to dwell a moment on the importance of setting ambitious goals. And I'm reminded of this because I learned it in my early days at the World Health Organization. You know, in 1988, the World Health Assembly declared an ambitious goal of eliminating polio over the next 12 years. We did not reach that goal. Polio continues to inflict outbreaks across the globe, particularly in parts of the Middle East. But we succeeded in slashing that number of cases by 99%, ensuring that 20 million children would not suffer from paralysis. And it was the very act of setting that goal that it galvanized a generational coalition that changed what we thought was possible about how we could address infectious disease, and that set the stage for numerous other big programs that followed, perhaps most notably PEPFAR in 2003. And that's the power of setting big, hairy, audacious goals. It changes the paradigm of what we think is possible, and that's the reason that we can, we must, we are setting our own moonshot as an agency to eliminate health inequities by 2030. Now, I know that a goal without a plan is just an empty promise, and we can't do it alone. And so today we are crafting a strategic plan that we'll share in June that outlines exactly how we will get there, what the objectives and the measures are that we will use to hold ourselves accountable, and how we hope to engage the full array of healthcare actors, from other state agencies to providers to payers to private businesses, to accelerate that goal alongside us. Everyone will need to come to the table, and we will get this done.
That's an ambitious goal, and I look forward to seeing your progress on that. On a very personal note, you said that you feel comfortable sharing this with our audience, that as a teenager, you struggled with an eating disorder. What was that like for you? How did you recover, and how did it inform who you are today?
Yeah, and the reason, you know, I talk about this, Laurel, is because I believe it's incredibly important to destigmatize. I want people, and especially young people, to know that it's okay not to be okay, mm-hmm. and recovery is possible, and they can overcome. But to answer your question, I was diagnosed with anorexia when I was 15 years old, and with that one label, my whole world was shattered. I come from a family for whom speaking of mental illness, let alone admitting a member of the family has one, is completely taboo. And so for the longest period of time, both my parents and I refused to accept that I had this disease. And it was my doctors, my pediatrician, my psychologist, my endocrinologist, my OB-GYN, who reeled me back from that abyss and who gave me back my dignity, who helped me recognize that while society may condition us to believe that we're not enough, we're not good enough, good looking enough, perfect enough, we still can be whole. And there's not shame, but freedom mm-hmm. in asking for and accepting help. And so I wanted to pay it forward. I wanted to give that same gift, be a partner in healing to other, especially young people, that my doctors had given me. And it's really that spirit, that commitment, really, to the potential of every human life that I believe medicine beautifully encapsulates and represents, that I seek to carry forward in all the work that I do, especially now the work I do for OHA.
And did that guide you at all into the medical field?
Yeah. It was my physician's example that I sought to emulate, and the reason that I actually went to Stanford, where I was treated as a teenager, for medical school.
So we have about a minute and a half left, but I wanted to ask you about some, when you were a teenager, you started a couple of nonprofits, Girls Helping Girls, a social enterprise, Girl Tank, was that what it was called? Are those still in existence? Tell us about those.
Yeah, so I started a number of social enterprises when I was a young person. They really became a vehicle for my own healing. And they allowed me, in my 15-year-old's parlance, the goal was to build a sisterhood of change makers who could support one another and could address some of these global challenges that we still face all over the world today. And so I started my first organization when I was 15 and built it over 7 years into a global, on almost all continents, enterprise, supporting 30,000 young women to find their voice and create social change. And we were unfolded into a much larger women's leadership organization, to whom I was really grateful to pass the torch when I was in college. And then I started an incubator for those women, young women in our program who had done great things and wanted additional support and training and financial capital to take their projects to the next level. And that's very much still in existence. We were incubated by the government of Chile and headquartered in Santiago, and we're in over 100 countries, and I led that for a number of years.
I'm going to jump in here because we don't have much time left, but you've worn a lot of hats. You've had a lot of impressive jobs, your last one just 4 months in New Jersey. How long can we expect you to stay in Oregon? How long can we hold on to you?
I appreciate the tone of that question. I made a commitment to the governor. I made a commitment to my husband that we are here for the long haul. I don't want to be here for 2 months or 2 years. I want to be here for two terms, for as long as the people of Oregon will have me. And this is the community in which I want to lay down roots and build a family. So I'm excited to really get to know the state and to claim it as my new home.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us here on Straight Talk. And we hope you'll join us next week. We'll meet the candidates in the Democratic primary in the 3rd District. Have a great week. We'll see you next week for Straight Talk.